This is episode 4 of our 7-episode series on criminal procedure review. And as promised, we are going to move to the exclusionary rule. We first discussed the exclusionary rule in episode 1 when we reviewed the landmark case of Mapp versus Ohio, where the United States Supreme Court first presented the expectation for states regarding the exclusionary rule. And you'll recall in Mapp, the police officers entered Dollery Mapp's home without a search warrant and found obscene materials. Mapp was convicted of possessing these materials but challenged her conviction. This case was part of the court's revolution in criminal procedure during that time period, where the court applied provisions of the Bill of Rights to criminal defendants and made those interpretations applicable to the states. In particular, this case found that the exclusionary rule, which prohibits prosecutors from using evidence acquired illegally in violation of the Fourth Amendment, applies to both federal and state governments. It had been applied to federal cases for some time, and then this decision extended it to the rest of the country and state cases. Dollery Mapp was convicted of knowingly possessing lewd and lascivious books, pictures, and photographs in violation of Ohio's criminal statutes. You know, probably things that are all out there all over the place, right? In a lot of different contexts today, but and would seem ridiculous, I guess, to most people, but it was a different time, right? It's 1957, and 3 Cleveland police officers, all these cases, you'd almost think that they originated in Ohio back then, but this one also in Cleveland. 3 Cleveland police officers arrived at Dollery Mapp's residence on information that, and I'm going to quote what it was listed in the court case, a person was hiding out in the home who was wanted for questioning in connection with the recent bombing, and that there was a large amount of policy paraphernalia being hidden in the home. Now, I don't know if the material they found in the trunk in the basement was that policy paraphernalia or what that means. We're not told, but that's what they were supposedly interested in. A person and things. This was a 2-story building split into a 2-family dwelling. So there was a first floor apartment and a second floor apartment, as I read it. And Mapp and her daughter lived on the top floor, and somebody else lived in the bottom floor. It was never clear to me who lived in the bottom floor, but Mapp lived on the top floor. Upon arrival at the house, the officers knocked on the door and demanded entrance, but Mapp called her lawyer, and her lawyer said to refuse to admit the police without a search warrant. At that point, the officers left the house, called headquarters, and they were directed to set up surveillance on the house. About 3 hours later, 4 or more additional officers arrived on the scene, and they once again went up and asked for entrance. When Mapp didn't come to the door immediately, at least one of the several doors to the house was forcibly opened, and the policeman gained entry. Meanwhile, Mapp's attorney arrived, and the officers wouldn't permit the attorney to see Mapp or to enter the house. It appears that Mapp was halfway down the stairs from the upper floor to the front door when the officers entered the premises and demanded to, and at that time she demanded to see their search warrant. There's a paper that claimed to be a warrant, and it was held up by one of the officers, and Mapp grabbed that warrant and placed it in her bosom, is what the case states. And some of you probably been on strange calls that had incidents that were close to this. And if not, you probably will. But that's what happens. She grabs a warrant. She sticks it in her shirt. A struggle ensued, and the officers recovered the piece of paper. And then they handcuffed Map because she was being belligerent, as what they described. And then they took her in handcuffs back up the stairs to her bedroom, and they searched her bedroom, a dresser, a chest of drawers, a closet, some suitcases. They looked in a photo album, personal papers, and things of that nature. Eventually, the search spread to the rest of the second floor, including her child's room, a living room, a kitchen, and a dinette, and eventually to the basement where a trunk was found, and that trunk contained the materials that she was eventually convicted of possessing. At the trial, there was no search warrant ever produced by the prosecution, nor was the failure to produce a search warrant ever explained or accounted for by the prosecution. So we can assume no search warrant. Now, suffice to say, we're a long way from Map-type circumstances being even remotely acceptable or seen as a norm today. Now, we have circumstances that come up that cause the exclusionary rule to come into play, but typically that's not these types of circumstances. You wouldn't find yourself on a raid of this type under these types of circumstances. What should stick out is that the initial attempt to gain entry, the police, went to the door and didn't gain entry, and then they go sit for 3 hours. And then these other officers arrive. Now, if it was today and you were with the first group of officers who weren't able to gain entry and you were told to keep the premises under surveillance and some other officers arrived, I guess we would assume that those other officers arrived with a warrant, right? With a valid search warrant. That's what would typically happen today. Time, circumstances, the fact of the case, those things should stick out. And definitely that three-hour period stood out, and it should stand out to you. Now, was Map up to something? Probably. Was contraband found in her house? Yep. But what happened? Well, one of two things. Either the police didn't have or believe they had the ability to obtain a warrant, and or even with that three-hour lag, someone got sped up. They didn't breathe. They didn't get oxygen to their brain. They didn't think. They didn't apply the law. The exclusionary rule prevents the government from using most evidence gathered under circumstances a court determines violated the United States Constitution. The decision in Map established that the exclusionary rule applies to evidence gained from an unreasonable search or seizure in violation of the Fourth Amendment. The decision of Miranda versus Arizona, as discussed in Episode 3, established that the exclusionary rule applies to improperly elicited self-incriminatory statements that were gathered in violation of the Fifth Amendment, and to evidence gained in situations where the government violated the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Now remember, the rule only applies in criminal, not in civil cases. We must also remember that if evidence that falls within the scope of the exclusionary rule leads law enforcement to other evidence that they would not otherwise have located, then the exclusionary rule applies to the newly discovered evidence, subject to a few exceptions. And that secondarily excluded evidence is what we call the fruit of the poisonous tree. The fruit of the poisonous tree is another doctrine. Remember, doctrines of law are not statutes. Doctrines of law are principles of law that are extended by the court, created by the court. So the fruit of the poisonous tree is a doctrine that extends the exclusionary rule to make evidence inadmissible in court if it was discovered as a result of other evidence that was also illegally obtained. Or firstly, I guess, illegally obtained. As the metaphor suggests, if the evidential tree is tainted, well, then so is the fruit. The fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine actually preceded the exclusionary rule. It was established in 1920 by a decision, Silverthorne Lumber Company versus United States, in which the Supreme Court adopted the phrase fruit of the poisonous tree. That came to us then through a 1939 case, Nardone versus United States. The rule typically applies to testimony evidence resulting from some other excludable evidence, such as, and most typically, an excluded confession. Like the exclusionary rule itself, the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine is subject to three important exceptions. The evidence will not be excluded if, number one, it was discovered from a source independent of whatever the illegal activity was alleged to be. Number two, the discovery of that evidence was inevitable, essentially not connected. It would have eventually surfaced. It was inevitable. Or number three, the evidence was found as a result of excludable voluntary testimony from the defendant themselves. Remember, the defendant doesn't have to take the stand, but if they do, whatever they say, admission. Though the rationale behind the exclusionary rule is based on constitutional rights, it's a court-created remedy and deterrent. It's not an independent constitutional right. The purpose of the rule is to deter law enforcement officers from conducting searches or seizures in violation of the Fourth Amendment and to provide remedies to defendants whose rights have been infringed. Courts have carved out several exceptions to the exclusionary rule where the cost of exclusion outweigh its deterrent or remedial benefits. For example, the good faith exception, which I'll discuss in a minute, does not trigger the rule because excluding the evidence would not deter police officers from violating the law in the future. So let's talk about the good faith exception. Under the good faith exception, evidence is not excluded if it is obtained by officers who reasonably rely on a search warrant that turns out to be invalid. In the written materials, I provide you with some cases that ruled that, you know, the exclusionary rule does not apply when the police conduct a search in reliance on a binding appellate precedent. Evidence may be admissible if the officers relied on a statute that was later invalidated. A finding that the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule applies when police employees erred in maintaining records in the warrant database. So they didn't go out to violate the law. There was some good faith effort. Another exception is the independent source doctrine. Evidence initially obtained during an unlawful search or seizure may later be admissible if the evidence is later obtained through a constitutionally valid search or seizure. And I listed some cases in the material. So essentially, if we look to the map case, if later they had come back, if later they had, you know, some allegation that she was distributing this lewd and, you know, the pornography of the time or whatever, and they had enough to get a constitutionally valid search warrant, they could have a constitutionally valid search and seizure. And then she's subject to prosecution under that basis. That's different than inevitable discovery. And inevitable discovery is related. It was also adopted in one of the cases that extended the independent source doctrine, Nix versus Williams. The inevitable discovery doctrine allows admission of evidence that was discovered in an unlawful search or seizure if it would have been discovered in the same condition anyway by an independent line of investigation that was already being pursued when the unlawful search or seizure occurred. That goes to that reality that a lot of times people that are involved in criminal activity are involved in several different lines of criminal activity. And it may very well be that there are multiple investigations or potential investigations going on at once. The attenuation doctrine, in cases where the relationship between the evidence challenged and the unconstitutional conduct is too remote to be attenuated, meaning reduced in force or value, the evidence may be admissible. Maybe. Now, who decides if it is? Court. And that's probably the least applied of those exceptions. The exclusionary rule does not prevent the prosecution from introducing illegally gathered evidence to impeach or attack the credibility of a defendant's testimony at trial. Now, we know that the defendant doesn't have to take the stand, but if they choose to take the stand, as with anything else, the prosecution has latitude and the exclusionary rule doesn't prevent the prosecution from introducing something that would have been deemed illegally gathered for purposes of impeachment or to attack the credibility of the defendant's testimony. Now, it has to be related to whatever the defendant eventually testifies about. But we can pretty much gather that if this comes up, the defendant is probably going to testify about something and trying to deny or explain something away. It is in all likelihood related to whatever had been illegally gathered in the first place. Now, you're aware of qualified immunity, and due to qualified immunity, the exclusionary rule has traditionally been a defendant's remedy when police conduct an unreasonable search or violate a suspect's Miranda rights. Even if officers violate a defendant's constitutional or statutory rights, qualified immunity in theory protects officers from a lawsuit unless no reasonable officer would believe that the officer's conduct was legal. But as we know, this exception is always under the microscope and subject to various attempts, legislation and lawsuits. So as those courses come up, and you know, they're more frequent, be aware. If you have the benefit of a union and a union rep, I'm sure they have information. So what's the bottom line here? What's the bottom line on the exclusionary rule? Most exclusionary rule issues are avoided when the people involved take a deep breath, when they slow down just a bit to remember what they know about the law, the things we've reviewed in the previous three episodes of this series, the things that you've learned in courses, the academy, your training. Just take a deep breath. Just slow down. Breathe, slow the heck down, and follow the law. And that's the bottom line. It's as simple as that when we want to know how to avoid evidence being tossed out by the exclusionary rule. Now we're going to dive deeper into how to avoid any issues in a more focused manner in the next two episodes. We're going to cover warrants, both arrest and search warrants, and then in the that's in the fifth episode. In the sixth episode, we'll cover search without a warrant. So your memory will be refreshed on things you should know already, and you'll be fully equipped to avoid exclusionary rule issues. But the cases make it clear, and you know from your experience, the issues come up when someone fails to slow down and apply the law. When that adrenaline starts pumping and you feel a tightness in your chest or a pit in your stomach, that's your signal. It's a very quick four-step process. A deep inhale through your nose, hold a second strong exhale out of your mouth. That gets the oxygen to your brain, engage your brain, and follow the law. Just follow the law. This is episode 4 of our 7-part series. I appreciate you all, and I hope you stay safe. And if you need me, you know where to find me.